Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way.
To check out the video version of this episode, go to youtube.com/Mormon Stories. To keep these podcasts alive, please consider a financial contribution today at mormonstories.org, and thanks for listening. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. We're here live at a very special location. We're here at Utah Lighthouse Ministries in downtown Salt Lake City with Sandra Tanner. For those of you who don't know, Sandra and her beloved husband, Gerald, are kind of famous throughout Mormonism, and some would say infamous, for the ministries which they created many, many years ago. They started struggling with their faith in the church, let's just say in the 50s.
59.
And started their ministries in the 60s. And they've been sort of labeled as the anti-Mormons sort of the 20th and 21st centuries within the church for many, many decades. Many believing Mormons who were raised in the church were taught to view them as scary and as sinister and as evil people. That's one perspective. But many of the people that I've spoken with have interacted with the Tanners over the years and have found them to be delightful and honest and caring people. And so the purpose of this interview is today is to ask some questions to Sandra, to learn about her life, about Gerald's life, to learn more about their motivations for why they started UTLM, and to learn about all the many ways in which they were sort of in the middle of almost every significant, let's just say, controversy or historical event in the church for the past 4 or 5 decades. So I'm really excited to be here. This is an interview I've wanted to do for a long time. And Sandra Tanner, welcome to Mormon Stories Podcast.
Oh, good.
It's good to have you.
I hope it's good to be here.
We're here in your famous offices.
Mm-hmm.
You've had this building for how long?
About 20 years.
Before that,
we were in our home in our front room.
Where was that?
Next door.
Next door?
Yeah.
So you still live next door?
Mm-hmm.
So you live next door. You bought the house next door.
Yeah.
It's now your office. Many, many important people have traversed this door and these passageways over the past several decades. And we'll be talking all about that. But as we do in Mormon Stories, let's go ahead and start by going way back. And let's talk about a little bit about your ancestry and about your early years in the church before you started having questions.
Okay. Well, I'm a great-great-granddaughter of Brigham Young. And my mother's maiden name was Young. It's a direct line down from Brigham Young through his son, Brigham Young Jr., and then he had a son, Walter, and then my mother, and then me. And my father's family converted in about 1912 or something like that to Mormonism. My father's family were extremely devout Mormons. My grandpa, I would say, was like Joseph Fielding Smith. That's my dad's side. On my mom's side, her father had died, and my grandma was a widow and always wore her garments but drank coffee in the mornings. And it was sort of like a, I don't know, trade-off. if I wear my garments, I can have coffee. I don't know just how she viewed that. But so my folks were married in the Salt Lake Temple, and I was born here in Salt Lake.
Around what year?
I was born in 41.
41, the year we got into World War One, World War II, sorry.
Yes, yes.
All right.
So my folks at that point were pretty much into the church. But then they moved to California for my father to be in defense work, and that opened the whole new world of beaches and other competing things to Sunday school.
Sin.
And but my father always believed Mormonism, even though he wasn't real active. My mother I don't know when her doubts first started. I know when I was in grammar school, the garments ended up being in the drawer all the time. My folks quit wearing their garments. And somewhere along the line, and I'm not sure just when, my mother read Fawn Brody's book, No Man Knows My History.
Which would have come out in the late 40s, right?
Yeah, but I don't think she read it that soon. I think we're talking in the early 50s.
Okay.
Probably. She read it. Her older sister read it. My grandma, young, read it. And I didn't know any of this. So they start having questions before I knew anything about that there were questions.
Were they, like, really dedicated to honesty or integrity or truth?
Was it just a curiosity?
No,
it was a truth quest. They wanted to know how things really happened. I'm not sure what first started my mom down that road. She'd been troubled by the temple ceremony, which would have been in the 30s. She was troubled by the garments, hated them. Of course, in the 30s, they were less than attractive.
Which is hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine. Baggy, one-piece, very awkward things. Anyways, I'm not sure what all made her start questioning Mormonism. But my grandma said that one day they got up in Relief Society and said, told all the women, don't read Fawn Brody's book.
Oops.
And so I don't know if that what made them aware of it or if they'd already bought it. But so anyways, I'm going to seminary. And
so you attended church?
As a young person, it was hit and miss. My folks liked to go to the beach on Sunday, so I was the one that put the guilt trip on the family. That, yeah, it's Sunday, we should go to church. Where do we get this kid, you know? And I don't know why it was so much more important to me, but it was more important to me than the rest of the family. So,
was there a time where you started going every week?
When we got to be teenagers, when my sister turned a teen, then we started going regularly, and they wanted her involved in Mormon activities, youth activities. She had kind of got hanging around some kids that weren't as desirable, and I think that spurred my dad on that we better make this more regular so that they develop friends in the Mormon community. So trying to get my thoughts straight here. So anyways, I'm going to seminary, and
What city are you in?
This is down in the San Fernando Valley.
Okay.
And so when I was a kid, we were going to the Reseda Ward, which is the south end of the valley. And then we moved up to the north end of the valley. And that's when my sister and I started really getting active, more so than my folks were. So my mom starts this quest to figure out how the story really happened. And the more she looks into Mormon history, the more involved she gets in the study. So she and my aunt started combing the bookstores for used books on Mormonism to collect the, and we're talking early Mormon books. They wanted to find what early sources they could to see what things read originally. And I'm sure Brody's book kind of gave them a list of stuff that they were looking for. So when I'm going to seminary, my mom's got all this stuff spread over the front room floor studying the critical problems in Mormonism. And so she starts baiting me with questions to ask in seminary. And I didn't even know what I was asking, you know. I mean, and so I go, I have a question. And so I just found that I would just be put off or told, well, when you go through the temple, you'll understand. When you get older, you'll understand. You know, it was and always just some sort of, or it's one of the mysteries kind of thing. Well, that was okay in high school. I bought that. I thought, okay, that's the way it works. You'll find out later. Then I got into Institute of Religion. And
where?
Down in the San Fernando Valley. It was down in Van Nuys. They had a college down there. And it was just the start of the Institute program was really just getting underway at that time. They started up the Institute in the San Fernando Valley. I'm not sure how long they'd had it going, probably longer at UCLA and USC, but it was fairly new in the Valley. And we used to get together with the other schools for dances and activities and stuff. So anyways, the teacher would just bring things, different things up in the lesson that would trigger something my mom had said. And so I started asking questions at Institute. Now I was thinking a little more about, and I couldn't even tell you now all the things that came up, but I would just, they went in context with the lesson and I would ask a question. So finally one day, he asked me to stay after class, that one of the girls in the class was thinking of joining the Mormon church and I was disturbing her with my questions. Well, I didn't even know any really good questions back then. That wouldn't have taken me out of the church, but it troubled me that I had waited through high school because in seminary, you just had sort of volunteer people doing this. When you get to Institute, this is a guy trained at BYU to teach Institute. So if you don't ask there, where are you going to ask? So anyways, I was told I couldn't ask any meaningful question. It was at that point that my grandma from Salt Lake had been down visiting for the winter, and this is spring, and she asked me to come home with her on the bus to Salt Lake to accompany her back. So I said, okay. Well, I had a boyfriend at BYU that I wanted to check on, so I was afraid he's looking at the girls, and it turned out he was. I came back on the bus with her, and we get home and she had a house up on the avenues and she going through her mail. And here was a little card announcing a meeting. And it was that Sunday evening. And she asked me if I would take her to this meeting. And I said, well, I didn't want to at first. I said, well, what kind of meeting is it? And she says, well, it's sort of like a Mormon fireside. So I asked Grandma, so what kind of meeting is it? And she says, well, it's sort of like Mormon fireside. My grandma was always very cagey, and if she didn't give you a straight answer, you knew there was a reason. She's hiding something. And I couldn't figure it out. So I finally figured, okay, it's a bunch of old people, and she doesn't want to tell me it's going to be all old people because I won't want to go. So I finally said, okay, I'll take you to your meeting. So we drive across town, and I walk up to this house, knock on the door. This nice-looking young man answers the door, and his name's Gerald Tanner. And that's how I met my husband.
Okay, really quick. Did you feel at the time like you had a testimony?
Well, that's a curious thing.
High school, did you feel like Holy Ghost? Did you ever bear your testimony?
Yes, I had done all of that. However, in my last year of high school, I would have struggled with that. Up till senior year, I was all with the program. But by then, my mother had said enough things to me that, you know, no big questions, but I just wasn't sure.
But when you say with the program,
I was fully invested in Mormonism.
Did you have good experiences?
Oh, yeah.
Talk about good experiences.
I loved Mutual. I loved Mormon Fireside. I loved seminary. I loved all my friends. I had a great ward, nice bishop. I mean, I don't have any bad...
Had you read the Book of Mormon?
No, I had read parts of it. I hadn't read it all through.
And had you prayed to know if the church was true?
Not in that sense. Because my mom was asking questions, I never got that kind of pressure to do that. I think my dad just sort of backed off with my mom because he didn't want to get involved with the discussion of the church. He was happy, it was true, and if you got to go on your own quest, that's your problem, you know. And so it was just sort of like he compartmentalized, she's on some crazy quest, and he's just ignoring it.
But you would have enjoyed your church experiences,
yeah.
And you were glad you were a member.
Yep, not looking for any way out.
And you would have borne your testimony, I know this church is true, all
now
that stuff.
Just before I met Gerald, I at one of our firesides, I remember, this was just about a month before I met Gerald, I remember bearing testimony at this fireside saying, I finally feel like I have a testimony. I've struggled this last year not knowing whether I could really say it's true, but I now feel convicted. I know it's the only true church. Well, I had arguments with my mother before senior year about polygamy, and I I'm defending the whole thing to my mother. And of course, I mean, you know, I'm like 16, right? Okay. Mom, if the church said today to go to Mexico and lift polygamy, I would do it. Mm. And my mom's looking at me like, Sandra, you have no clue what life's about. You don't even know what you're saying. And I had no appreciation at the time for that. But so, I mean, I was defending Mormonism to my mom. I went through several years there of
being an apologist, basically.
I'm trying to, and I didn't know anything. All I could say is, I know it's true, Mom. You know, but what did I know, you know? So I finally get to where I think I have this testimony, and I meet Gerald. And, okay.
So let's go back now, talk a little bit about Gerald's background.
Okay. Gerald's from a fifth-generation Mormon family, the same as me. The Tanners are longtime supporters of the whole thing. John Tanner in Kirtland saved the church financially, or helped with some of the finances. But when you get up to Gerald's parents, his father went to BYU and then went to MIT, became a meteorologist, worked his whole life to retirement out at the Weather Bureau.
Whoa, MIT, that's a big deal.
Yeah, he also became an atheist.
Oh, that's even a bigger deal.
So Gerald was raised in a home where his sweet mother tried to raise him as a Christian, and she had...
Not LDS.
Yes, of course. They were both fifth generation. Fourth generation Mormon families. Yeah.
Okay.
But she just had a high school. She didn't even finish high school, I don't think. She was in a plane wreck, if you can believe, in a stunt plane accident in Eureka on the 24th of July one year. And the plane crash killed the pilot and her boyfriend and put her in bed for a year. So she didn't finish high school. So here she marries this very educated guy. And she's at the disadvantage with his atheism and her Mormonism. She doesn't know how to defend her faith.
Do we know why he became an atheist? This is Gerald's
science.
Father.
Evolution, science, yeah. Okay. He just walked away from everything.
Age of the Earth and flood and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, the whole thing.
Okay.
And so his mother tried to raise him as a good little Mormon boy.
In what city?
Well, Provo and Salt Lake.
Okay.
Gerald's family had a big fruit farm in Provo and lived here in Salt Lake. So they commuted all the time to take care of the farm. Gerald's older sister was devout Mormon. Gerald, as a teenager, I mean, as a young person, he had thought the church was absolutely true. As a teenager, he found out that not all the boys went to priesthood meeting. And in fact, somebody knew how to sneak liquor out of somebody's house. And so they thought that was a lot more fun to drink beer behind the ward house or something. And so Gerald was a rebellious teen. Not because he had a problem with Mormonism, but just because he was a rebellious teen. And so when he got to be 18, the one day at church, the bishop's making little hints to Gerald, it's about time for that mission. And what are we doing to get ready, you know? And back in the 50s, the church sent people on missions to reform him. Now, like when you had those talks a few years ago, we want quality missions, you know.
Raise the bar.
Raise the bar. Okay. Well, there is a reason they wanted to raise the bar, because in the 50s, kids got sent on missions to reform them.
Okay.
And, you got a problem with your boy smoking? No problem. We'll send him on a mission, you know. So, I mean, it was just the way things worked. And you didn't refuse those things. I mean, so it just was part of the culture. You sowed your wild oats and then you went on a mission. So Gerald, it was drinking, and I think he smoked some. I didn't know him at this time. So anyways, he decides, wow, mission? How seriously do I believe this whole thing? I have to really do some repenting if I'm going to go on a mission. So he decides he's going to read the Book of Mormon. So he reads that. Oh, well, okay, yeah, I can believe the Book of Mormon. I'm cool with that. And then he was working some little part-time job somewhere. He was going to the U, I think, at the time. And somebody challenged him on what he believed. Do you really believe all of this? And so he starts trying to think through his faith. So he reads the Encyclopedia Britannica article on Mormonism. And it mentioned there were different kind of Mormons. Well, he didn't know there were any kind of other kind of Mormons. So he went and asked his mom, Mom, what's this about the reorganized church? Oh, Gerald, we don't talk about those things. You know, those are all bad guys. We don't talk about splinter groups. And so now he's, of course, he's a rebellious teen, right? Okay, so he says, well, I wonder what those guys are about. So he looks up in the phone book, and here's a reorganized church in Salt Lake. And he thought, I wonder what those guys do over there. How is it be different than Utah guys? So he goes over and visits. Well, the pastor is so excited to have a Mormon kid come in his door, and he starts plying Gerald with everything that's wrong with Brigham Young. Let me tell you about blood atonement and Adam God and polygamy for exaltation. And so he's telling Gerald about all this kind of stuff.
And this would have been 57, 58.
Yeah.
And was Gerald your age about?
No, he's 3 years older than me.
3 years older, so he would have been born in
38.
So yeah. If he's 18, that's 56-ish, 57?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
And so that starts him on that. Well, then he goes to church at the Reorganized Church, and there's this man there named James Wardle that had a barber shop downtown. And James had one of the largest collections, private collections of books, of original books on Mormonism in the state. He had different editions of the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine of Covenants, the Times and Seasons, Messenger and Advocate. I mean, he just had, at the back of his barbershop, he had all these books.
Was he active LDS?
No, he's reorganized.
Oh, reorganized too.
Him at the Reorganized Church.
Okay.
And
James Wardle, Reorganized Church barber. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And so James tells him he needs to come to his bookstore, to his barbershop. So Gerald goes down there, and James gives him a copy of David Whitmer's pamphlet, An Address to All Believers in Christ, where Whitmer, witness of the Book of Mormon, argues that the Book of Mormon's true, but Joseph's a fallen prophet. He changed the Doctrine and Covenants. All this stuff's wrong. Throw it all out. Just go back to the Bible and Book of Mormon.
And didn't he say this whole Melchizedek priesthood thing?
Yeah, no Melchizedek priesthood.
We knew nothing about that.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Okay.
And so Gerald was incensed. He was sure David Whitmer was just lying through his teeth. And then he got thinking of, and at first he just throws the pamphlet down. And then he got thinking, well, if Whitmer's right, I ought to know that. And if he's wrong, someone ought to expose him. So he goes back and studies the pamphlet some more, and he decides to take a trip to Missouri, to Independence.
Okay, did he ever serve a mission?
No.
Okay, but this is all in preparation for a mission.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Okay.
He's trying to figure out if it's true.
Okay. I guess that's an important thing to do before you go on a mission.
Yeah, before you go on a mission, you want to make
sure.
Some
would say.
So he gets in his jalopy, and of course, this is before AAA or anything like that, and drives back to Missouri. He had all kind of wild things happen, but he finally makes it back there, car breakdown, everything. And he visits the different churches. He met Peter Whitmer's granddaughter, I guess it was still alive. And she could remember David Whitmer writing the pamphlet when she was a young girl in the home. So she had to be a little kid and now really ancient.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And so Gerald was interested in trying to find a Whitmer church. You know, and she says, oh, no, that's all long gone. Nothing like that's going on. So, but Gerald visits the different splinter groups. He went to the Temple Lot Church of Christ group. And he wanted to know about Whitmer's claim that the Book of Commandments reads differently than the Doctrine and Covenants. So they get him out of Book of Commandments. And
now, this would have been 1835, the original
Doctrine and Covenants. 33 is the Book of Commandments. Okay. 35 is the Doctrine and Covenants.
So 33, printed in Kirtland, right? Probably.
Okay. 33? Right. Okay. I can't remember. Okay, so anyways, he verifies that Whitmer's right. The revelations have been reworded. And this is very disillusioning to him.
Significant rewordings, like the change the meaning? Is it like Book of Mormon where they like capitalize letters
articles? Whitmer talks about that these changes were important to him. That originally the revelation said the only gift and calling he had was to bring out the Book of Mormon.
Joseph.
That Joseph only had that one calling. And then in 35, he rewrites it to say that's just your first calling.
Oh.
So that was very disturbing to him. Did he have just one calling? Or was it just the start of his calling? So that was a big, important change to him. And, of course, you got the whole priesthood argument and all these things that Whitmer had in his pamphlet, that Joseph was adding these things later. Well, you look at the 33 Book of Commandments, there's no priesthood in there.
Yeah, and we still don't have a date for the Melchizedek priesthood.
Right, but at least you have some kind
of... If Whitmer didn't know about it, if it wasn't in the Book of Commandments, then and there's no date,
right.
That's like when did the Melchizedek priesthood really happen?
Right. And so visiting around the splinter groups, he visited a little Church of Christ Book of Mormon group. And these were people that mainly had come out of the Reorganized Church and the Temple Lot Church of Christ group. And they believed just the Bible and Book of Mormon. Very humble, sweet Christian people, really loved the Lord. But they rejected everything in Mormonism, but the Bible and Book of Mormon. And so Gerald stayed with them for weeks. In fact, he stayed with them twice before I met him, where he stayed for weeks with them. And through this all, he decided he could believe like the Book of Mormon, which would sound very much like believing like a Protestant, that salvation was by grace and that you didn't need temple work and priesthood and all these things. Just go back. I mean, the Book of Mormon is fairly Protestant. Which I find so funny. Mormons are always saying to me, Mrs. Tanner, have you ever read the Book of Mormon and prayed about it? I said, yeah, I read it, prayed about it, and I left the church and believed the Book of Mormon for a couple more years. But so Gerald came home with this conviction that following Christ was different than following Mormonism. There would be no mission. There would be no temple marriage. There would be none of those things. He was just going to go with the Bible and Book of Mormon and follow Christ the best he could figure out how to do. And so he's having this little meeting at his house, playing some lessons and teachings and stuff from this little group in Missouri.
What do you mean, on a recorder?
A little tape, reel-to-reel.
Okay.
Yeah, way before cassettes.
Do you still have those?
Reel-to-reel.
Do you still have those reel-to-reels?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And things that were brought up in the meeting were things my mother had said to me at different times. So it wasn't like a big shock. I had heard a lot of these same kind of problem areas in Mormonism before. But the operative word here is Gerald was really cute. And so, what can I say? So after the meeting, I went up to him and I says, well, that's really interesting, Gerald. Why don't you come over to my grandma's house and tell me some more? And he was so excited that someone had finally listened to him. Oh, dear. And so anyways, he came over to my grandma's and starts telling me about Whitmer and all this stuff, leaves me all kind of stuff to read. And
why does he care so much? Like, why didn't he just go, oh, my gosh, this isn't true. I'm done with this. Why do you think at this point he's like driving out to Missouri and staying there for weeks and coming back and holding cottage meetings and playing recordings? Why is he doing all this?
To Gerald, because once he was challenged on the mission, he was on a truth quest. Okay, I want to find out what the truth is about God, the truth about the church. Is this the church God called me to serve in? And so, yeah, he had been an inactive, rebellious kid. But at that point, he took life seriously and decided truth was important and he had to get to the bottom of it.
Well, I would say there isn't a listener out there that wouldn't, or a viewer, that wouldn't, you know, agree that truth is important. But like traveling in the late 50s to a foreign state, staying with people, again, cottage meetings, all this study, this is like an extra level of caring.
Yeah. Right. And I think that was born from staying with the people. Well, even before he stayed with the people in Missouri, there was just that deep drive in him to know what God really wanted from him.
So was there something special about, what about insight?
He was a very conscientious person. When we first started dating, one night we were driving back from his mother's to my grandma's, and it was just sheeting and rain. And some people had broke down to the side of the road, and he stopped the car and went out to help these people with, I don't know if they needed pushed off the road or whatever it was, but I mean, it was pouring rain. And he stopped and went out and helped them with whatever they needed. It really impressed me that that he had that kind of ethics or concern to do that. But you would not have been impressed that he was necessarily a real spiritual person. It's hard to say what drove him. I don't know, other than there just was this deep-seated need to know what was true.
Was he a negative person?
In some ways.
Like overall, negative personality, critical personality, or?
No, he was somewhat negative on society. He felt the world was full of sin, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but no, Gerald had a sense of humor and was someone that you would have enjoyed being around. Gerald was very shy, though, and that's why most people never met him, because he was an introvert. I don't know how much that played into the whole story of his life. As a high schooler, he was involved in magic and developed a magic show. I mean, he spent hundreds of dollars on magic systems. This was a big thing for him in high school. He did shows at the, what do you call them, whatever kind of things they do at school, you know, programs and things. And that maybe in some sense was part of the drive, because he saw in magic the sleight of hand and how easy it was to deceive people. And I think he felt when he got into looking into Mormonism that he had been sold a magic trick and someone was doing sleight of hand. And he wanted to get to the bottom of it. So I would, his involvement in magic made him somewhat of a skeptic, and that drive to know, am I just watching a trick here, or is this really something that's happening?
But you still think he was seeking truth, not trying to tear things down?
No, because he goes into this group in Missouri because he's looking for God. And he knew he was a messed up teen, and he comes to this little group and they're talking about there's forgiveness in Christ. You can come to him and you don't have to do temple ritual. You don't have to do all this stuff. And none of them smoke or drank. And it wasn't like, oh, well, now I can feel free to do that, because this little group was very straight arrow. But there wasn't the legalism and the law of Mormonism in it. And he just felt that God took those things away from him, the smoking and the drinking. I mean, he just quit.
So in preparing for his mission, he investigates Mormonism, finds Jesus, and leaves the church.
Yeah, well, he hadn't formally left, but he quit going.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
So then when I meet him, here's this cute guy, and so I invite him to my grandma's, and he starts telling me all this crazy stuff about Brigham Young. Well, I told him I was a descendant of Brigham Young, and it's like the spider to the fly. Oh, have you read any of Brigham Young's sermons? No. And he says, well, can I bring you over some? Well, yeah, I guess so. So he brings me over these different Journal of Discourses. So here's a sermon on the only men that become gods are the ones that practice polygamy. The Civil War will never free the slave. Adam's our father and our God, and the God, only God we have to do with. But then the real hard one was when he showed me Brigham Young's blood atonement doctrine, that there are certain sins that you could commit that the blood of Christ wouldn't cover, and only your own shedding of your own blood would cover that sin. And I can tell you exactly the sermon it was that just really kind of was the last straw for Mormonism. And that was the one where he says, let me suppose a case. Suppose I found my brother in bed with my wife and I put a javelin through them both. This would be a righteous act. It would save their souls. They'd go to the celestial kingdom and I'd be justified for this. Mm. And I mean, most Mormons are not as focused on Brigham Young as I was, because that's where I descended from. So I heard great stories about how God saves polygamists when they are faithful to the cause. So here's a man that's been, Summers coming to Salt Lake City where it was going to the Daughters of the Utah Pioneer Building. It was going to Temple Square. It was going through the Brigham Young home. This was a man I'd always idolized. And here Gerald showing me this blood atonement sermon that just absolutely horrified me. And I put that down and I says, okay, I'm ready to look at whatever you want to show me. Obviously, the problems are bigger than I realized.
And these were all in the Journal of Discourses.
Yeah. We're not talking about any anti-Mormon books here. Mormon stuff.
Okay.
And then Gerald tells me, well, you realize, of course, that the Doctrine and Covenants doesn't read like the first edition. I said, oh, really? No, I didn't know that. And I went down to Sam Weller's bookstore. grandpapa, the guy that runs it now. I went down to Weller's bookstore and I bought a reprint of the Book of Commandments. Not a photo, they didn't have that yet, but a typeset of the Book of Commandments. And I bought a current Doctrine of Covenants. And I came home to my grandma, I was staying at my grandma's, and I came back to my grandma's house and I asked her if she would read the one with me against the other. Now, I didn't realize and appreciate at the time how unusual it would be for a grandma who's wearing her temple garments faithfully, that she would not have a problem doing this, you know. Oh, sure, that sounds like a great project. So we sat there for a couple days reading the Book of Commandments against the Doctrine of Covenants. She read the Book of Commandments to me. I had a DNC, and I'm writing in the margins. Now, wait a minute. Slow down, Grandma. I got to get this written in here. And then it would get too big, and the paragraph would be taken out or put in. I said, wait a minute. I'll just have to make a note. See the Book of Commandments here. Okay, Gerald had already ruined Utah Mormonism for me. But now I'm looking at Joseph Smith. I'm looking at the Revelations. And I'm thinking, the creator of the universe could have said it right the first time. Why would he have to go back later and tell, why would he tell Joseph Smith in the first place he only has one gift? And then 2 years later, shift it to, oh, no, that's just your first gift. And that was one of Whitmer's concerns. And the changes on priesthood, what you would know today as, what is it, sections 2-7 and 27, I think, are priesthood sections. They weren't in the early first edition. Well, one of them was in a shorter form. But all these things grew in later editions.
Wasn't there a section, was it 101, that denounced polygamy?
That's in the 1835 DNC. Oh, and that DNC was another thing that came up talking with Gerald about polygamy. I said, well, what about all this polygamy stuff? And he says, well, the church originally didn't have any trouble with that stuff. So he gets out and shows me the 1835 that says, inasmuch as we've been accused of fornication and polygamy, we believe that one man should have one wife except in the case of death when either is at liberty to marry again. Okay, so we have in the Doctrine and Covenants a section saying we don't believe or practice polygamy, 1835. So how come they're living polygamy if they got this section in the DNC? And that was in the DNC up until 1876. Through the whole polygamy period, they have this. So Gerald's telling me all these kinds of things that are just pulling the rug out from underneath me on Mormonism. I had been a happy Mormon. I was not looking for an out. This was...
But your mom had planted the seeds of doubt.
Yes, my mom had... Well, I found out later that my grandma had raised her kids, never get up in testimony meeting and say you know the church is true. You get up and you say you believe it's true. You aren't old enough to say you know.
Now, is this the descendant of Brigham Young?
The one that married into the Young family.
Okay.
And so grandma obviously had doubts much earlier than Fawn Brody because her kids were raised with this, which I would say is a different take than what most of the Mormons would have been raised on. So, now I've lost my thought. Where were we at?
So you studied the DNC Book of Commandments side by side.
Yeah, and so then I had, Gerald and I would talk and talk and talk about what does this all mean? Where do we go from here? Well, what am I to believe? Why would I still believe the Book of Mormon? Then why not just leave it all? What's all of this about? And he said, well, the whole point is God called Joseph Smith to bring out the Book of Mormon. All the rest is false. Throw that away. Just go back, believe Jesus, and just follow the Bible and Book of Mormon. And then he takes me through the Book of Mormon. See, the Book of Mormon says there's only one God, like the Bible. It says there's only heaven and hell, like the Bible. It doesn't have any work for the dead. It doesn't have any preexistence. It doesn't have any temple marriage. The Book of Mormon says if you die without accepting Christ, you're eternally sealed to the devil. And then you got in the back part of the Book of Mormon where it talks about baptism of infants. Most Mormons don't read the part that says, if you never hear the gospel, you don't need baptism. Unto such baptism availeth nothing, according to the Book of Mormon. Well, then who are we doing temple work for? Nobody needs it. Either you already lost the game or you don't need it. You're going to make it anyways. So, Gerald and I had a whirlwind romance. I knew Gerald for 2.5 months when we got married.
Whoa!
Yes, that's what my family said. by the way, family, I'm dropping out of Mormonism. I'm marrying an apostate, and we aren't getting married in the temple. And we're going to have a Protestant minister marry us. Other than that, do you have a problem with this?
Okay, real quick. So many people who struggle with the church today stick with it for longer than their initial doubts. And they either succumb to social pressure or they say, well, the church is good even if it's got problems. Or they say, well, the church is flawed.
Yeah.
But, you know, the church is perfect but the members aren't. Or, you know, of course, leaders make mistakes. And they have all these ways of sort of thinking through things that sort of lead to them sticking around. Or they remember their positive, even spiritual experiences, and they say, I can't deny that. What kept you guys from sticking around for several years? Why was it, I mean, in the 50s, that the pressures must have been intense, exponentially more intense than now.
Yes. Well, I have to tell you, when Gerald and I got engaged and we had a month to prepare for the wedding, I mean, I'd been up in Salt Lake. I dropped out of school, stayed here. I go back for a month before we get married. I went back to church. So when I got back to California, in a sense, I guess you'd say I fell back into my normal life, but I didn't fit anymore. I now knew that there were problems. And I talked to my different friends about it. I talked to a couple of my friends' fathers about it. And you just haven't prayed enough. You didn't read enough. You're too young. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, if you'd have gone through the temple, this would all made sense. And there were all these kind of ways to try to move me along and get me back in the track. And I said, well, yeah, but what do you say about the changes in the revelations? Well, I'd never heard of that. They just know it's true. Well, what about Brigham Young's sermons? Oh, well, that's old stuff. We don't worry about that anymore. Well, he's talking about slitting people's throat to get them atoned for their sins. That seems kind of serious, you know. And, oh, well, you can't believe all the stuff you read, and you don't know whether that was recorded right. And, you know, they just have all these kinds of things. Well, once Gerald and I got married, we lived in California the first year of our life, of our marriage. But Gerald was not going to go to the church. I mean, I guess I would have been probably, I probably would have gone through that longer route. I know I would have eventually left, but I probably would have been gradually pushed out because I had read too much at that point to have stayed. My mom had read too much to let me stay. I mean, there was too much around me of critical thinking and research on Mormonism to think that I could have walked away from knowing what I knew. But
sounds like your mom's doubt and Jared's father's atheism maybe were two important things that let you guys leave when others might not have been able to.
Right. Yes. Had my mother been a strong believing Mormon, that would have been very hard to have stood up to her. I didn't even really understand how strong my dad's testimony was until a little ways into that first year of marriage, till finally he started saying things to me about, you know, well, Gerald doesn't have the priesthood kind of stuff. And so then he started to get more vocal. I guess it was one thing to watch my mother have questions. Another thing to see your daughter, who was the most active in the family, walk away from it. So then he starts trying to engage me on those things. But he hadn't studied anything like my mother had, so he had no real defense other than, well, we have the priesthood. We all know that, you know. I said, well, Dad, I don't know that anymore. So the first year of our marriage, the ward teachers would come around because we were still on the rolls, and we went through several sets because we would ask them about these things. Oh, great, come in. Yeah, well, can you explain to us why the Doctrine and Covenants has been changed? Well, so then next month,
were you seeking answers or were you just trying to mess with people at this point?
Well, we wanted, okay, well, I'm open. You got an answer?
Yeah.
Sure. You know, I don't think you do, but, you know, hey, if you got one, I'll listen. And so we get a new set of teachers next week, next month. Well, anyways, we kept trying to tell everyone about David Whitmer's pamphlet. And they didn't know quite what to do with David Whitmer because they all wanted to go with his testimony, the Book of Mormon's true, but they don't want to know the rest of what he said.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's not all he said, you know. So anyways, Gerald was more and more convinced that there's no going back. The whole thing's dead in the water. Now, what I didn't know was that Gerald had started to have questions about the Book of Mormon, and he did not talk to me about those. We used the Book of Mormon every night for devotionals.
Really?
Along with the Book of Mormon Bible. Yeah.
So a religious couple.
Yes. Oh, religious. Yeah. We were so religious that scared my whole family. They thought we were gone nuts. Fully committed Christians, daily Bible, Book of Mormon studies, prayer time. So, yeah, we studied Mormonism, but there was that spiritual aspect of using the Book of Mormon daily as devotionals. And Gerald, of course, will read the Bible, Book of Mormon. Okay, so Gerald starts more and more to be troubled by the quotes from the King James Bible in the Book of Mormon. And these start troubling him. How could this be a translation and come over from these whole different language by now? The Nephites have changed it all, so no one can read it. So you got this whole different language, and we're going to translate it into English, and it's going to read just like the King James Bible. And so he's really struggling with some of these different areas. And he had written to Pauline Hancock back at the Little Church of Christ in Missouri asking her about how do you reconcile this? How do you still believe the Book of Mormon when you can see so much of the Bible's in the Book of Mormon? So the rationale was God can give the same words to different people, good old Book of Mormon phrase, and so he could give the same words to the Nephites as he gave to them in the New Testament. Well, yeah, but this is B.C., and we're getting Paul's phrases.
you know, I mean, how is Paul showing up?
How do you work this out?
Hundreds
you
know? Of years before Christ America.
Right. So, anyways, Gerald's struggling with these kinds of areas, and I didn't know yet that these were problems. And we were reading all kind of Christian literature. We started visiting around Christian churches, and we didn't fit. We didn't fit because we still believed the Book of Mormon. And in Southern California, I was just out, just scandalized. We went to this Protestant church. It was probably a good church, but I was too judgmental. So I go in, oh my word, there's a woman sitting in front of me in a sundress. How could God be here? How could anyone be so shameless as to come into the house of God wearing a sundress? You know, well, it gets worse. They served coffee in the lobby.
Mm.
I mean,
Jesus ain't having none of that.
You know, just. But so we didn't fit, and we wanted to be involved with other Christians. But I didn't know their language. I didn't know their method of service. Everything was a strange world that I, and it's every memory, every good memory I had related to Mormonism. And I'm in this sea of Protestants that I don't understand and I don't fit with them. Because the pastor would come visit, oh, that's so great. You came out of Mormonism. Wonderful. And then he'd get talking, you still believe the Book of Mormon? Yeah. Why? Well, because I prayed and I know it's true, you know. But the problem was, so this is, you know, 60, 61. Well, yeah, 60, we moved back to Salt Lake. But even Salt Lake, we had the same problem to a degree. Pastors could talk to you about general outline of Mormon doctrinal differences with standard Christianity, one God, many gods, that kind of stuff. But none of them knew the Book of Mormon well enough to tell us why we shouldn't believe that anymore. And so they'd go on about, oh, well, you know, Joseph Smith taught plural gods. Yeah, I don't believe that. Because the Book of Mormon says one God. See? And they wouldn't know what to do with that. So they didn't know how to help me because they'd never dealt with anyone that just believed the Book of Mormon and didn't believe the rest of the package. So we moved back to Salt Lake, mainly for research. We wanted to be able to go to the University of Utah.
Why keep researching? You knew it wasn't true.
Because all our families were Mormon.
So?
Because they bug you. And they all want to set you straight. They all want to help you over your difficult period. And no, look, okay, it isn't just one sermon on blood atonement. Let me get you a list. And so we made up a list of stuff, and we put out one little sheet of paper.
So you're trying to justify your decisions.
Not justify. We're trying to convince them that Mormonism's a lie.
Why?
Well, because we believe Christianity. We thought if Jesus is real and the Bible's real, and of course at that point the Book of Mormon, and it all talks about Jesus, you guys are going down the wrong way.
How'd you get a testimony of Jesus?
Well, reading the Bible and Book of Mormon.
Reading the Book of Mormon. The Book of that's Graham Palmer's argument. It brings you to Christ whether or not it's true. Looks like that's true.
That it was. We backed out of Mormonism in that sense. Threw the Book of Mormon out.
So tell me about your testimony of Jesus. Did it happen all at once or?
No, the more I read the Bible and the Book of Mormon, the more I was grounded in this other belief of that there's only one God and it's all through grace, not temple work, not priesthood and everything. But then
did you receive a spiritual witness?
Yeah, I was listening. One Saturday, I was home alone. I was listening to a Christian radio program.
Here in Salt Lake?
No, that's in California.
Okay.
And this minister came on, and he was preaching from 1 John chapter 4. Herein is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as propitiation for our sins. And as he discussed that chapter, if you look at it, the first part talks about false prophets, and he wasn't dealing with that. He was dealing with the second half of the chapter on God sent Christ to pay for our sin. And as he went through this, and it just hit me, we love God because he first loved us, and that's in that 1 John 4 chapter. And that was such a revelation to me, that because I'd always assumed, well, of course God loves me. I'm his child, you know? And so here's this minister explaining, no, you were in sin, hopeless, without the atonement of Christ. Christ loved you so much that he first initiated the step to make you reconciled to God. So we love him because he first loved us. And this was just such, you know, wow. So it was just such an amazing thought to me that that I failed God every day, and yet he loved me and made the move to me to bring me to reconciliation, and that it didn't have anything to do with going to church or paying tithing or any of those things. It was a matter of coming to God and accepting his forgiveness and accepting what he had done for me. And so listening to that radio program, that's when I had my conversion experience of accepting Christ as my Savior.
And do you imagine that that's very similar to the experience that a Mormon claims to have about Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon? Same feelings, emotions, joy, peace, comfort, tingly feelings, hair standing up on your arm, goosebumps, all that
stuff?
Well,
it's not the way I heard my friends talk about knowing it was true. It was more a matter, and I mean, maybe somebody does, but the ones I talked to, my friends, those around me, it seemed much more of a less profound experience of just, I prayed, now I have a conviction that it's true.
For you, it was what?
For me, it was a shattering experience. I sat on the couch and cried for an hour. Because of sensing this lack in me being able to be right with God, no matter what I did, I wasn't going to be the one that made the connection to God. It was a God made the connection to me. And to see that grace explained was something I'd never seen in Mormonism. Now at sacrament meeting, we'd sing, what's the sacrament songs they sing? But there were a couple of different sacrament songs that touched me about the atonement as a Mormon. But everything's muddled in with the rest of Mormonism. It's like there's, four steps to the gospel, and there's the atonement, and then there's baptism, priesthood, and temple marriage, and you work on all this stuff. And so it was all part of the package. And so this made Christ important in a way that I never heard in Mormonism, in a personal way that I'd never seen in anyone around me. Now, the people at my ward were very nice, lovely people. I have nothing to criticize them on that regard, but I was experiencing God in a way that I had never heard anyone explain to me in Mormonism.
So it was a logic chain of understanding plus a deep emotional spiritual experience.
Right.
And it had a lot to do with you feeling the love of God and a forgiveness of your sins. You know what? That sounds a lot like Joseph's experience.
Well, yeah, except God and Jesus didn't show up.
It sounds a lot like his original
account
of his experience.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
Well, if anything happened to him in the grove of that nature, I would feel he walked away from it by what he did later.
Okay, but maybe that's how it started for him too.
Could have been.
Because what you're telling me sounds a lot like what he experienced.
Well, it's the typical revival scenario. I mean, you read the Methodist revival meetings at the time, and ever since, that's the way revival meetings were. That's the way people that go through
But it happened to you.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
So you believe in that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And it changed your life?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So
how do you become, How do you start creating this? How do you go from Christians to this?
Because all our family are saying we're nuts, and you can't prove any of that. That's not what the books say. I never heard that. If that were true, I would have heard it in church. I've gone to church my whole life, and I never heard these things you're talking about. Okay, I'm going to get you 10 references on blood atonement. So I put up a sheet on that. You never heard of Adam God? I'm going to get you a whole page full of references on Adam God. And so it's a defensive measure in a sense that all our friends and families are coming at it. I mean, we're just two young kids. We didn't know anything, you know, but they're all coming, and they treated us like we didn't know anything too. You know, you dumb kids, what makes you think you know anything? Look at the educated men at the head of the church, and they don't have trouble with this. So.
And it sounds like, you know, there's this typical saying that's kind of offensive. They can leave the church, but they can't leave it alone. It sounds like they wouldn't let you leave it alone. Is that
right?
Kind of, is that
yeah.
kind of true?
Right. And I think that's true for a lot of people.
That you feel like you have to defend yourself.
You stay engaged because your family pounds on you all the time.
You feel judged. You feel insulted. Yeah. And so you want to defend yourself.
Right. Right.
And explain it.
Yeah. My grandpa, who on my dad's side, that was the fanatic Mormon, he said to me one day, "Sandra, the problem with you is we can never have a good discussion. You turn everything into an argument." And I went home and I tried to think that through, try to figure out what is he talking about. And it dawned on me, if I would let him pontificate for a half hour and say nothing, we had a good discussion. But at the end of the half hour, I said, "But Grandpa, see, you turn everything into an argument."
I've had that experience with some people too. Okay, for my entire life, The gold standard prototype for anti-Mormons mm-hmm. has been the Tanners. Were there anything comparable in the early 60s?
No, there was some
anything.
The little pamphlets. There was one minister who had done a book called God, Sex, and Mormonism or something like that. But it was written for Christians, and it was fairly surface, doctrinal stuff. And so for the Christian, they could say, okay, I don't want to be a Mormon. But for the Mormon, it didn't tell the Mormon why they'd want to be a Christian or why they wouldn't want to be a Mormon. There was some little tract societies that put out some tracts on Mormonism. But there was, I mean, other than Brody, there was very little out there.
Nothing well-known, nothing mm-hmm. prominent.
No.
But there was Fawn Brody.
Yeah.
So was she an inspiration a little bit?
Yeah, she gave us the...
Did you meet her?
I did later.
Okay, but not earlier.
Not at that time. She gave us the outline of what the early books were, that if you're going to study Mormon history, these are the sources you're going to want to be looking at in her footnotes. So we started going to all those kind of sources, and that's why we wanted to be at here in Utah, where we go to the University of Utah, so we could see all these original books. And then we realized that as we did more and more study, that we should make these pamphlets bigger. More people were interested in what we were doing, and we were just giving these all away. And it was getting more and more of a financial burden on us to just give. We bought a mimeograph machine, and we're just doing these little copies.
One of those purple things that you hand cranked?
Yeah, yeah. And so we're putting out all these little papers, just giving away free to anybody that wanted. But then a fellow that had a little bookstore here in town said, if you'd put a little price on those, I could get them in the bookstore, and you'd get a wider audience. Okay, so we put a quarter on these little pamphlets. And, like 5 pages, 10 pages long, just little pamphlet things, on blood atonement, polygamy, Adam God, changes in the Doctrine of Covenants, contradictions between the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine of Covenants, all that kind of stuff. And we started picking up and finding out, geez, there's some people that really will read that stuff. Everyone doesn't want to argue with us. There's some people that are actually interested. So then we started finding other people that were studying Mormon history. And Gerald was a machinist. He did that for the first 5 years of our marriage. And then finally he said to me, we got to make a decision what we're going to, if we're going to keep doing this research and printing it, then we've got to decide to do it full time. I can't keep doing my job and come home and do all of this too. Of course, by that time we had started a family, had a couple of kids. And so finally in 64, we decided we would go full time trying to support ourselves on the sale of the books. And at first,
what books?
That's what I was going to get to.
Oh, okay.
Oh, how do you build a life on this? So our first endeavor was to do a photo reprint of the Times and Seasons, the Evening and Morning Star, the Messenger and Advocate, the Elder's Journal, early Mormon publications that either side will want to study.
Right.
And Mormon scholars have to go to the university to read this stuff. What if you live in Louisiana? How would you research Mormonism? Okay, we'll do reprints of all these early books so that a researcher, no matter where they're coming from, could just get cheap copies and sit in their own front room and do their research. Hey, there's a plan. So that's what we did. That's how we started out. And we financed our research for our Shadow Reality from selling reprints of early Mormon books. And then we started selling reprints of early anti-Mormon books and started building up a whole line of these reprints. And we first started a business called Modern Microfilm Company to microfilm the books and then make photocopies of them, print them. And so it wasn't until 83 that we decided to close down the business, which never made money, and start the nonprofit organization.
83?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we just missed the late 60s all through the 70s.
Well, yeah, but that's the way the bookstore went.
Okay.
All kind of other stories, but that the bookstore evolved from that mimeograph machine that we got in California.
So the first bookstore was what year?
Well, the first bookstore, 62.
You guys. We're selling your pamphlets through those other bookstores.
Yeah, it's something like that, yeah.
And the reprints?
We hadn't done the reprints yet. That's when we were doing our own little pamphlets. 62, we started putting little prices on, put them in the bookstores.
Okay, okay. So when Gerald decides to do this full-time, around 65, 64, 65?
64.
Then what do you do? How do you make an income? How do you feed those little kids?
By selling all these reprints of the early Mormon
newspapers
and all.
And you did that for how many years while you're writing? Was Mormonism, Shadow and Reality your first?
We were doing that at the same time.
Writing it?
Well, we'd already done an edition before at 64.
Okay.
A mimeograph one that just said Mormonism on it. And in 64, that was a monumental year. Our third child was born. Gerald quit his job. We bought the house next door, moved in and went full time. We typed round the clock to get the 64 edition of Shadow out because we knew we could pick up sales from that. And we also were doing the reprint of the Times and Seasons at that time, I think. So that's how we launched our little bookstore in our front room.
Selling your own book along with these reprints.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was that scary? What was that like to just have your husband quit his job?
Well, yeah, the walk of faith. Well, the scarier part was before that, in about 63, when Gerald decides he's going to print the temple ceremony. That one gave me a little pause. I said, Gerald, you don't know how people respond to that. You know, that might get people a little mad. And once we lived through that, I figured.
What was the response to that?
Well, people come call me on the phone and tell me off. But they didn't come and bomb my house. You know, at that time, we lived up on the avenues in a little wood frame house. And I thought, oh my goodness, they're going to burn us alive in this house.
You did live in fear.
Yes, at that point, because I didn't know where the line was. You know, how much opposition can this community take before they would retaliate some way?
Because we do have a bit of a history of that.
Yeah, you know, so destroying printing presses and all, you know, so We did have some problems, like when we'd take stuff to be photocopied. Before we got our own photocopy machine, I took some of our old newsletters in to have photocopied, and in one of them was the issue where we announced we were going to do the temple ritual, and we had a couple of photos of a guy in temple clothing. And the guy got halfway through the photo job, hit the newsletter with the guy in the temple clothes, called me on the phone. He says, "You're going to have to come pick up your work. I won't finish it. I won't do this." So then we learned that we got to make sure we're just dealing with either national companies or send the work out of state. Because the local people, we never know what their real attitude is going to be, and we were afraid they'd destroy our work or something. So we had to do our own printing. We had to learn. When we bought our printing press, we didn't know anything about it. It came with an instruction manual. You know, so fools rush in. But
so when you start this, did you call it a company when Gerald goes full-time? Okay.
Yeah, Modern Microfilm Company.
Okay. What's your justification? What's your motivation? Like, you're talking to each other. Okay, Gerald, it's time to quit. We're going to do this full time. Why? Why are we going to do this? I know I've asked you this before, but by 64, 65, why are you doing it?
Because we felt that the Mormon people were being lied to, and we felt Mormonism was deceiving them on the means of salvation, and that to keep telling people to go to the temple was an affront to God. So it was driven by setting the record straight, by wanting the truth of Mormon history to be told, but also from a spiritual direction. We felt the Mormon people were being given a false hope through Mormonism.
Led away from Christ, basically.
Right.
So
right.
For you, did it feel like a spiritual...
Yeah.
Did you feel moved to do this, like led by the Holy Spirit?
Well, yeah, it just seemed like some things just fell on our lap and have all through the years, different documents, finding different things. It just seemed like, like when we got our press, Gerald says to me one day, "If our tax return comes tomorrow, can I use the refund for down payment on a printing press?" Well, I'm doing a quick calculation of the odds. I said, "Okay, well, it came. I mean, wouldn't you know?" What were the odds? So Gerald felt that was a sign that we were to get a press and to go forward with all of this.
So you felt led by God?
Yeah.
Okay. So...
But not in the sense of like Joseph Smith having a revelation, but in a sense of an inner conviction that we owed it to those around us. To share with them what we'd found out.
So was it an act of love?
Well, I felt it was. They didn't see it that way. But yeah, so to me, it's like if you see your loved ones inside a burning building, they may not know the building's on fire, and you go in and try to shout at them and warn them, come out, the building's burning, and they're sitting there saying, well, there's nothing wrong in this room. Well, yeah, but the back half's in flames. And so that's the way we viewed it. We're trying to get the people out of the burning building, and they feel secure because they can't see the fire.
So you want to help them see it?
Yeah.
All right. So how did it grow?
How did it grow?
Like, did you make good money from the very first year?
We went broke. No. We learned how to rotate the bills. So that you could stay one jump ahead of the next guy on rotating the bills. No, we were always going broke. You look at our earliest newsletters, and we're always having sales because or asking someone to loan us money. We needed $1,000 to pay our paper bill. Will someone loan it to us? We'll pay you interest and sign a note and everything. No, it was very hard times. Don't go into this if you want to make money. This is not the place to be. That's what I find so funny. Mormons will come, "Oh, I bet you just did it for the money." And I think, my goodness, if I worked at McDonald's, I could have made more money. No, it never was profitable. And that's why we went nonprofit, was because different ones that were giving funds to help us, like Wes Walters, that wrote The Inventing Mormonism with Mike Marquardt. Wes was a Presbyterian minister in Illinois. He wasn't on a big salary either, but he was giving us monthly donations to keep us afloat. And he said, if you guys would get nonprofit, more Christians would support your work if they could get a tax write-off on it. You really need to go nonprofit. So we did, and it did help. We did get more support that way. And I make this fantastic income now. And
you're joking.
Yes, I'm joking. I will switch with any general authority that wants to switch his modest living allowance. And I think I'm going to get a big raise.
So how did the business strategy grow? So you go from, you know, pamphlets and this early book and reprints of early church publications. Like, let's just go into the late 60s, 70s. Are you growing a business model? Is it like, let's do retail? Let's...
No, we just have some little racks in our front room. In our Victorian house, it has a parlor and a front room, and it has sliding doors. And so we slid the doors to block off our front room from the parlor and used the parlor for the bookstore. And so I just had these little racks with our different publications on there, just our different reprints and things. And the Institute was buying reprints from us.
What?
Yeah.
The LDS Institute?
Mm-hmm.
Leonard Arrington and T. Edgar Lyon? No.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Before Arrington's time.
Lowell Bunyan and T. Edgar Lyon?
T. Edgar Lyon did. I knew him. And Reed Durham was president, head of the Institute.
After?
At the University of Utah.
After Lowell Bunyan.
Yeah. And talked to Reed many times, and I knew many of the Institute teachers at that time.
Why were they buying your stuff?
Because they wanted to be able to read those reprints in their front room and not have to sit at the university to read them. And so, but I guess you'd say I built the bookstore model. I wanted to bring in more than just our publications. I said, Gerald, we need a broader selling base than just our books. And so one by one, I started bringing in other titles, like Fawn Brody's book was an early one. Different ones like that that I started bringing into the store, into our little front room.
Probably wasn't easy to buy that in the 60s here in Salt Lake City.
Well, no, we had to order it from Knopf. And that was a problem for us. That we're just a little mom and pop thing to get recognized as a retailer, to get wholesale prices. And well, we finally got that going and started getting different books brought in. And gradually, the bookstore just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then 20 years ago, when we moved in here, then we were able to expand the bookstore even bigger and bring in more titles. But we are limited how far we can go here because of the size of the room, unless we dedicated some other rooms to it.
Or go on the internet.
We are.
Sell through the internet.
We are selling some of our books. We're doing PDFs and selling some of our things now on the internet, which I hope in time will develop a bigger audience. But the thing that's really hurting us and all bookstores is Amazon,
right,
and the internet. They can buy books in bulk. They undercut all the bookstores. Everybody's hurt by that.
Right.
Anyone with a storefront is hurt by Amazon and companies like that.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories Podcast. To check out the video version of this episode, go to youtube.com/Mormon Stories. To continue the conversation or to keep these podcasts alive through a financial contribution, please check us out at mormonstories.org, and thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy your hearts will swell.